Hi, Upgrade listeners. Before we dive into the show, just want to make a quick note that towards the end of our interview with Judith Matloff, we start to ask her things that are a little outside of her wheelhouse. So please take her answers with a grain of salt during the lightning round segment of the show, and she's making her best guess. Don't take it as concrete advice. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Alice Bradley, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Jordan Calhoun, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And today we're talking worst-case scenarios.
That's right. We're learning the best things to do to ensure your survival in every type of situation, from earthquakes to bombings,
to simply choking at the dinner table. Everything is dangerous.
Here to give us our best survival tactics is crisis reporter Judith Matloff.
I think it's human nature to be optimistic and to be in denial and think nothing's going to happen to me. And, you know, but the thing is, things do happen. And when you have a plan, and again, if you've rehearsed it, you will feel calmer when it actually happens.
Judith has over 40 years of experience covering crises around the world. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Forbes, among other publications, and she now teaches crisis reporting at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism.
Judith is also the author of several books, including Homegirl, Fragments of a Forgotten War, and No Friends But the Mountains. And her latest book is called How to Drag a Body and Other Safety Tips You Hope to Never Need.
So, Jordan, have you ever been caught in a disaster situation?
I've had a lifetime of stress dreams that I think have prepared me for real life situations. And in my stress dreams, I always survive. I have yet to die in a stress dream. I am Jason Bourne when I'm asleep. But never in real life have I really had to, you know, go through a real serious life or death emergency type situation. Have you?
I've been close to stuff. And as we'll discuss in the interview, have not performed well. Typically, I've frozen, and that's not great. It turns out once I was in a restaurant and there was a shooting right outside the restaurant.
Huh.
People were running and ducking, and I just sat there looking like
soaking it all in.
What are you guys doing? Why are people running into the restaurant? Yeah, had no. And luckily, it turned out nobody was badly injured, and it was fine as these things go.
And you're still here with us. You survived
it. I'm still here. Another time, I was on the street, and a guy ran out of a store, and he clearly tried to rob it. And the guy who owned the store was just beating the shit out of him, and he was just covered in blood. And someone looked at me and said, call 911. And I took my phone out and stared at it. I was just like,
really?
I don't know what.
Huh.
I totally froze. I totally panicked. Mostly because there was like, it was still happening. Like there were, things were still happening around me. And I was like, should I flee?
I thought that I hadn't been in any serious emergency situations, but now that you're describing those, I have seen a number of fights and a number of fires, and I have been the person to call 911. And in those times, I've been pretty calm, I guess. It sort of seems surreal when everything is chaotic around me, and I was able to call and have an even voice and basically explain what was going on. I think partially because I have, maybe because of these Jason Bourne stress dreams, this false sense of invincibility where I'm just talking as if things are pretty normal, even though there's chaos around.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe I have an inflated sense of survival and you have a deflated sense of survival.
Yeah.
Maybe with our powers combined, we can be a perfectly normal person in a crisis who can get out of it alive.
Maybe together we're invincible.
Exactly. With our powers combined. Well, hopefully after our conversation with Judith, we'll be a lot better equipped to handle these future crises. Shall we get into the interview?
Let's do it.
Judith, thanks for being here with us.
My pleasure. This is great.
So tell us a little bit about your background as a crisis reporter.
Yeah, Most of my career, which has lasted about 40 years, I've been dispatched to write about and report on areas of crisis. A lot of wars. I covered Latin America, the former Soviet Union, Africa. And as a foreign correspondent, you invariably get yourself into situations, whether or not you want to. For instance, when I was based in London, the IRA was bombing outside Harrods department store. And so, you know, I'd just be walking down the street in a place like London, suddenly a bomb would go off. So when you're a foreign correspondent, you have to be prepared to cover these things. And of course, you get very extreme weather conditions. So I just kind of fell into this stuff, not by design, but simply by the nature of the work. And then what happened is, because I had made so many ridiculous mistakes myself, I started thinking about how I could train others so that they wouldn't make the stupid mistakes that I made. And to give you an example of some of the stupid mistakes I made when I started out, one was just, I was in an African country called Angola, and a war broke out, which we didn't expect, although we should have. And suddenly a car bomb went off outside my hotel and shooting would break out in the street. And so I would immediately gravitate and walk towards wherever the shooting was, which is a really stupid thing to do. So when I returned back to the United States and started teaching at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, I began to incorporate safety protocols into my teaching so other people wouldn't make these ridiculous mistakes as well.
Yeah, your story about Angola, I have to say, I was like, how are you still alive?
I don't know. Somebody likes me somewhere. Yeah. I mean, it was really stupid what I did. Because in those days, you'd get a phone call from your foreign editor at like 3 a.m. and they'd say something like, get on the next plane, you know, to Burundi because there's been a coup. You know, you kind of expected these 3 o'clock phone calls. And then you'd show up there and the editor would say, good luck, don't take any stupid risks. But they wouldn't tell you like how not to do that. So the stupid risks I took in Angola were, I had a satellite phone. It was one of the first models in those days. It was about as big as a coffee table's worth, $10,000. And nobody told me that you need a surge protector when there are energy shortages and then the energy surges back on. So I blew up my only communication with the outside world, which also cost $10,000. That was pretty dumb. Another thing which didn't go too well there was when the fighting broke out, the rebels who had returned back to war didn't really like my reporting, which was fairly objective and therefore didn't reflect well on them. So they put out a death threat against me and I had no plan to get out of the country, no exit route, because there was fighting at the airport, all the roads were landmined, and the United States didn't have diplomatic ties with Angola, so there was no embassy that could get me out. So yeah, but I'm still here. Hello.
Amazing.
I love the ridiculous mistakes because those are the types of things in hindsight that are so clear. Like, oh, I should have totally done this. And we all sort of have this idea of how we would respond in an emergency. Can you describe, like, what's your perception of the average person's emergency preparedness? You know, in all of these different contexts that you discuss in the book, how well prepared do you think the average American is for a crisis?
I think most people are not prepared, and that goes beyond America. I think the shifts in the world, I think it's human nature to be optimistic and to be in denial and think, nothing's going to happen to me, or, you know, that just seems so ridiculous. And, you know, but the thing is, things do happen. One thing which I think people should do, everybody should do, is take an emergency first aid course. And, you know, for instance, we have active shooters all the time. So if you know how to staunch bleeding, you could save a lot of lives, as passerbys did at the Boston Marathon bombing, for instance, or at that big massacre in Las Vegas a few years ago. If you know how to staunch bleeding, which is a very, very simple thing to learn how to do in just a couple hours, you can save lives, even at a car accident on the street. Or another example could be, you know, you're walking down, you know, you're hiking and you fall and you break your leg. Do you know how to set your own leg? These are the type of things. And one thing that we see time and time again are these horrific natural disasters that we're facing, hurricanes and earthquakes. And so many people don't have the basic preparation until it actually happens. They don't have a plan. They don't know where they're evacuating. They don't know how to react. Let's say there's a big earthquake. They don't know what they should be doing. And that concerns me. that really concerns me. And then when you also look at computers, for instance, you know, how much online hacking there is. And there's such simple steps that people can take to protect their data and their communications, and yet people don't.
You know, I think also about just being in these situations where an emergency breaks out. I'm sure we've all been there. And I've personally, I can tell you, I have reacted poorly. Like, you know, there's been, you know, like something terrible happens in front of me and I just freeze. Or in one case, I literally fled. I was out to dinner with my parents and a friend of theirs, and the friend started choking. And I was just hailing a cab before they could stop me and say, he's fine.
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
I ran. So I am definitely not a role model, but there's something to be said for, you know, thinking about these things before they happen and, you know, rehearsing them even in your mind. So when your adrenaline kicks in, you do the right thing.
Right. And that's what we do in the safety training that I do. And the thing is, if you had been taught how to do the Heimlich maneuver in one of these 4-hour emergency first aid courses, what you would have done is you would have said, everybody calm down. You would have said to your choking friend, it's cool, I've got this. You would have expelled the piece of hot dog or, you know, chicken bone, whatever was stuck in the throat. And everybody would have felt calmer, and you would have calmed also everybody around you. And that's why, you know, I just feel so strongly that we all need to think about the worst case scenario ahead of time. And then think about how you would mitigate or cope with it or even prevent it. And when you have a plan, and again, if you've rehearsed it, you will feel calmer when it actually happens, without a doubt.
I consider myself a planner to some extent, I guess. And one of the things when I would start creating my disaster response plan for, you know, what if I need to get out of New York or what if something terrible happened weather-wise, when I started creating those plans, something unexpected for me was the amount that you have to plan for other people, even if you're single. So you were talking in your book about an emergency contact. And one of the things that stood out to me, even as someone who has an emergency contact and sort of has a plan for them, was just how extensive it should be. I mean, this person is someone that you have to trust deeply with, you know, your passwords and your account numbers and who they should contact when and if something happens to you and all of this type of stuff. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship that someone should establish as an emergency contact and what types of things that person should be able to have access to?
Sure. I mean, make sure it's somebody you trust who isn't going to take all your passwords and then empty out your bank account. But, you know, it could be
mistake number one.
It could be a close relative. It could be a significant other. It could be your BFF. It's just somebody who you really, really trust who's also willing to take this responsibility. Like, you don't want to make them the contact person and they're actually a little bit uncomfortable taking on that responsibility. So you have an honest discussion with them. Yeah, you do want that person to have access to your passwords in case you need to shut down your accounts. That person needs to know where to find all your financial documents, your will, your birth certificate, your marriage certificate, whatever. And really, you should keep all those documents in one very, very safe place. In our house, it's actually a safe. And you keep that, and then this person will know the combination to the safe. But you want all that stuff easily accessible. I'll give you an example. My husband and I are in our 60s. We have a 19-year-old son. My worst case scenario with COVID is my husband and I are both going to be stricken. We're going to be in the hospital on ventilators. And our 19-year-old is going to be on his own in the house or wherever he is. And so we've set up a communication plan with my sister. The lawyer knows how to contact him. He knows how to find, you know, contact the lawyer. He knows where all these important documents are. He knows who the executor of our will is. We updated our wills, you know, and I actually felt really, really better doing this, although it sounds macabre, like I'm thinking about my potential death. I just felt so much calmer knowing that if my husband and I expire with COVID, my kid will know what to do and people will know what to do with him. And that creates a lot of peace of mind.
Jordan, I will be your emergency contact. Don't even worry about it.
I know that
as
you are excellent
seen,
under stress in emergencies.
I'm great in a crisis. I got it.
But she doesn't know how to save you from choking.
No, for the record, I know how. I just chose not to because I was afraid.
Alice is very selective on who she's going to save in a crisis.
I was just filled with terror.
No, and I understand that. I'm not judging you anyway. I understand completely. It is terrifying when you see.
You can judge me a little. Yeah. You can judge me. Yeah, it's hard.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So let's talk about doomsday prepping, or just prepping, right? Even the term doomsday has a connotation. I think we all think of it as like, it's been seen historically as sort of a fringe activity, but now it seems like, no, it seems like a thing we all need to do. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Can we get rid of the word doomsday and just say prepping? Because I'm not one of these people who believe in the end of days. I really don't think the apocalypse is coming. I think there's some pretty bad stuff happening right now, but I think the human race will survive and even our society might. But I think prepping, in my view, prepping is just what the Boy Scouts do and the Girl Scouts do. It's just being prepared. It's just thinking about what might happen to you. For instance, I live in New York City. You know, we were hit by Sandy a few years ago. The National Weather Service is predicting a particularly active Atlantic hurricane season this year. So what we did in my house is we just did all the preparations that we would have done for a Sandy. We updated our emergency radio, which is a hand-cranked radio, so you don't need a battery, you don't need a power source. We got those wonderful, updated, very, very lightweight forehead flashlights. We have a month's supply of emergency food and water and batteries and cash, cable, extra cables. In other words, so we're all ready. So if it hits, you know, we've waterproofed the basement because we flooded last time. So, you know, we tie down the furniture, you know, we're pretty much ready. That would be an example. So it's not doomsday. It's just, you know, stuff could happen. And, you know, what are the likely things that could happen? And I think we all should be looking in that direction. I mean, if you have kids go to school, does the school have a good program and a good plan in action in case there is a shooter in the school? You know, have you talked to your teachers about that and your principal? Things like that. So just, you know, think about what might happen to you and then plan backwards from there.
My planning all revolves around leaving, I'm realizing now. My emergency planning, like I have a bag with stuff in it that I could grab and leave if ever I needed to get out of New York City. So all of my, like, you could say a code word right now. You could say hippopotamus. And I'm like, okay, it's time to go. I've got a bag and I'm ready. I'm ready to roll. I would love to be more prepared for context where I am outside of my house and you're in a scenario where you don't have the normal things that you would have set aside for an emergency. So if I am out at a protest or if I am out at a movie theater and things get violent, what are some tips for how to respond in those scenarios where you don't have the things that you would normally want to have around you that you could use in an emergency?
Well, first of all, I think if you go to a protest, you should be prepared because even peaceful protests can turn into very kinetic situations right now. So I think anybody going to any protest right now should anticipate that there could indeed be some violence. So just have gear, you know, have a helmet in case somebody hits you on the head, have goggles for tear gas. Bring extra water so you can flush your skin and your eyes, and always stay on the edge of the crowd. I think so much of safety is not just having the go-to bag, which I think every single one of us should have, as well as an emergency medical kit, but a lot of it is tactical where you are. So if you go to a protest, particularly with COVID, you want to be socially distant as much as you can in a giant crowd of like thousands of people. Stay on the edge and always think about how you can extract yourself and where you would run to. So that would be one example of something that you could do in your Abbey house. And then this goes back to what we were talking about with the communication plan. You should always have your emergency contact alerted to where you are. If you think it could be a situation like a protest where something could happen, and you need to know how to find that person at any given time. And for a protest, for instance, I think one of your emergency contacts should be legal counsel, because so many people are being detained at the moment unjustly. So that's something that I would suggest that anybody going to a protest would already set up ahead of time.
Yeah, that just got me thinking, like, how do you get a lawyer? Like, I don't have a lawyer. Should I have a lawyer just on hand? Should I?
Always have a lawyer in your toolkit. No. What you could do is you could have the telephone number of the local chapter of the ACLU or the National Lawyers Guild, and they will give pro bono advice. I'm a journalist, so if I'm working for a news organization, they usually have legal counsel. So before I set out, I just say, hey, and who is the legal counsel? But yeah, those two organizations will provide free. But, you know, another thing which gets back to your point earlier, which is you should pretty much always have an exit route planned out. And you see, one thing which is going on right now with the natural disasters, the wildfires and the hurricanes right now this season, is that the normal evacuation shelters are not necessarily operating, because they can't accommodate as many people, or they have to think about social distancing, or hotels may not want to take people in, again, for health reasons. So this is something that I urge every American citizen who might live in anywhere where there could be a freak tornado or a freak hurricane or a freak earthquake, and there are a lot of freaky things going on, to find out now what would your evacuation route be and where would you go, because it may not be the same as it has been in prior years. So even if you live in a place like New Orleans, where I think people that live there pretty much know what the drill is, the drill is very different this year.
How wide do you cast a net in terms of who you're responsible for as an individual? You know, you could have kids, you could have parents, you could have siblings, nephews, nieces, aunts, uncles. How many people is it reasonable for you to be an emergency contact for, or for you to feel some type of responsibility to, in a hurricane or in some type of disaster?
I think that's thoroughly individual. And I think if you are going to take responsibility for people, you should be 100% willing to. And I don't think anybody should feel obligated to take responsibility for people that they really don't feel they can handle the situation for them as well. I'll give you an example. I mean, at the moment, I am fully responsible for my husband, my son, and our neighbor downstairs. She's elderly, and during the whole lockdown, she's become part of our pod and part of our family. Like, if something terrible happens, Adriana's coming with us. But just make sure that these are the people that you feel comfortable for, because ultimately, you can't take on more than you can actually handle.
That's useful. Thank you.
Yeah. How many people do you think you're
in? Well, I ran into probably a common situation when you're in that context of being mutual emergency contacts, is one of my friends and I were running the New York City Marathon, where you have to put down an emergency contact. And we were both running it. And we were like, well, this is stupid. We couldn't really help each other if we, we're both going to be probably a bit too exhausted to do anything useful. But that's the scenario we found ourselves in.
That's kind of beautiful. You could help each other over the finish line. Come on.
We both made it, thankfully.
There you go.
We both made it.
I'm impressed. I just admire people that run the marathon. It's not something I could do. I have enough trouble just walking down the street. I have great admiration.
Well, Alice and I couldn't survive Angola. We might not survive the winter, so.
You know, the thing I've also found is the human species is more adaptable than we think we are. Like, look about how, like, you know, we all, like, we don't, you know, kiss each other in the cheek. We don't shake hands. You know, we walk around with masks. We're very adaptable. When you're in a situation, you just adapt. So I'm sure you would have done brilliantly in Angola. Absolutely brilliantly.
Well, let's find out what some really good tips are for specific scenarios. Alice, do you want to do this lightning round?
Yes, we've come up with a lightning round. So, Michaela, start the clock.
The pressure.
Ready. Here we go. First of all, what's your top tip for each one of these? So first one, mugging.
Always have peripheral vision. Just look around you at all times.
Okay. Earthquake.
Do not stand in a doorway.
Ooh.
That's a myth. You're
really?
Yeah.
Wait, stop the clock, Michaela. Stop the clock.
Stop the clock.
So the deal, what you want to do is run under a sturdy table instead. So test the tables in your house. Like people say, what's sturdy? Jump on it. If it breaks, it's not sturdy. You don't want to go in a doorway because first of all, the door could hit you and the door frame could actually crash onto you. So you want to hide under something that can cover your whole body.
What if all your furniture is from IKEA and none of it's going to help? What do you do then?
Under your bed? That's probably, is that a good idea?
Might not be bad. And then, you know, grab your pillow while you're at it and put the pillow over your head. Yeah. But having said all this, again, and this is where contextual knowledge is really important. If you live in a place like Mexico, just run into the street. Like the wisdom in the United States where we have pretty strict building codes is don't run into the street because things can fall on you. If you live in Mexico or Chile or places where the construction is very, very shoddy or the regulations are not necessarily followed, run into the street. Don't hide under a table. Just get out of Dodge and get out of the building because the building's their pancake.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Back to the lightning round. That was a worthy digression.
Yeah. Okay. Bombing.
Run.
Okay.
Yeah. You want to get as far away from the scene as possible.
Shooting.
I could do that.
Shooting.
Distance is very important. If you can't get away, take cover. It could be behind a dumpster, something sturdy where the bullet can pass through.
Should you run in a zigzag?
Yeah, run in zigzag, kind of hunched over. That's really harder to do than most people imagine, so you might want to practice it. I went to a park and I practiced it. It's actually kind of hard, but once you get it down, you get it down.
Sexual harassment.
Set very strong boundaries verbally and psychologically. If your instinct tells you you are being harassed, but it, you know, it's kind of gray, trust your instinct. Be very, very firm with the person verbally and say, I do not like this. Please stop doing this. And then what oftentimes I recommend at least journalists do is they follow up with an email. You email the person and you say very, very calmly, I feel very uncomfortable about what happened and I'd like to get us back on a track where this doesn't happen again. And the beauty of doing an email is you can always forward the email to somebody else.
Yeah, I liked the email template in your book. That was really helpful.
Yeah, and it works. I've done this.
Next one is tsunami.
Tsunami, you want to get to high ground. And if you can't get there quick enough, hug a tree or something that's not going to topple over on top of you. The thing about a tsunami is it sounds like a lot of these disasters like a roaring train and the water is going to recede. So if you see a bunch of fish and crabs flapping away on the sand because the water's receded, that's your sign to get to higher ground.
Charging bull.
Run. I wouldn't wave a red, you know, cape or anything. I think run. I don't think standing your ground with a bull makes sense. And don't wave bells the way you do with a bear. That's not a good idea.
Severed artery. I assume somebody else's.
Apply pressure. It depending where the artery is, you would either apply a tourniquet or just general pressure with your hand. And that might mean sticking your hand inside the person's body. So that's why you need emergency first aid training.
Mentally ill person threatening you.
Walk away, run away. A lot of these things, running is really the first recourse.
So my MO, very helpful in all of these situations.
And, you know, if you run marathons, then we know you can run really fast and far. So maybe we should.
I am very prepared for the running approach to dealing with an emergency.
Next one is stampede, but I suspect the same. You're going to say
stampede. You can't run.
Okay.
I'm going to give you a tip because I have been in stampedes and they're really scary. Try to wrap your arms around something that can keep you up. Most people don't die because they're trampled. They die from the compression of hundreds of pounds of weight of other humans on their chest. So if the crowd is moving in a straight line in front, try to position yourself diagonally. And if you can, put your arms in front of your chest with a bit of an air space so that you can continue to breathe. If you're with other people, which I hope you are, lock onto them so that you become an immovable force with them.
Simba did this with a tree.
A tree would be good, a lamppost. Yeah, anything that can keep you upright. and try to get your chest into the lamppost or the tree so that 500 pounds of humans don't crush your chest.
Yeah.
Rabid dog.
Run and or throw something at it, you know, try to get it away from you. And if you get bitten, obviously just go for a rabies test right away and, you know, get a rabies shot. It's very painful. It's very expensive. It's quite extensive, but you don't want to take chances.
Finally, snake bite.
Don't try to suck out the venom yourself. Don't put alcohol on it. Don't put ice on it. Get yourself to a doctor.
There are two myths so far that we've debunked here. One is the standing in a doorway during an earthquake, and the other one is sucking out venom from a snake bite. Are there any other myths? If you could debunk a single sort of pervasive emergency response myth, what would it be?
Oh gosh, there's so many. Okay, there's an interesting one right now, which is very relevant, which is with wildfires. People are jumping into cold pools or, you know, they're shivering in lakes. That is fine, except when you have to come up and breathe. Because when you come up and breathe, there's radiant heat, which can sear your lungs and your respiratory system, which is really the way most people die in fires from suffocation. So if you are going to jump into a pool, and I understand why you would want to if you don't have any other alternatives, what you might want to do is have some scuba gear. I know it sounds bizarre, but you're actually under the water breathing. You also want wet towels or wet cloth so that when you do come up from being submerged, your face is protected by water. What you could also try to do if the fire isn't immediately around you is lie face down and put your face into the soil because the soil will be moist. What you want is moisture.
Wow. I think we've saved some lives.
I hope so. Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be nice. I mean, certainly your book will, but hopefully this interview will. Who knows? Who can say?
Can I give you another myth to debunk?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
If your finger or another part of your body gets severed, don't put it on ice.
What?
Yeah, don't put it on ice because the ice will kill the tissue. Wrap it up in, like, the best thing is always, I always have Ziploc bags on me. You just never know, right, if a finger is going to get cut off or something. So, and yeah, they don't weigh very much. So put the finger or even if it's intestines, just wrap them in something and have cool water. Keep it moist and cool, but don't have the water actually touch the finger or the exposed, you know, body part that just got severed. But don't put it on ice.
I feel like movies have lied to me.
Movies aren't good. Oh, I'll tell you another one. You know, in the movies, like there's bang, 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 and everybody hides behind a car. Do you know what part of the car you should be hiding behind? Because they never hide behind this part of the car.
Probably not near the gas tank.
Yeah, although that is a solid part of the car. What you don't want to do is hide behind the wheel. Sorry, you do want to hide behind the wheel. But what you oftentimes see them do in movies is they're hiding behind where the door is. Well, that's right. Not good because the door is like a tuna fish can. So the bullet can go right through it. It's pretty flimsy. Or the bullet could go under the car and like hit you in the legs as you're crouching. What you want to do is crouch by the wheel because the axle is a pretty sturdy part of the car. It gives you more protection.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Judith, thank you so much. This has been great.
This has been so much fun.
And now it's time for Upgrade of the Week. Every week, we talk about one tiny thing making a big difference in our lives. Judith, what's your upgrade?
My upgrade is sponges because my cats shed. And I tried lint rollers. It couldn't get the fur off. You know, I just, you know, shaking the material. Then I thought I'll just wet a sponge. And it just gets rid of all the cat hair.
It
from
works.
Furniture, clothing, from every surface.
That's actually amazing.
Is it a coarse sponge or a soft sponge?
A soft sponge. Just a wet, moist, soft sponge.
It just picks it up.
Every surface, it just picks up all the hair.
Wow.
And if you, well, I don't know if your listeners can look at me, but I have no cat hair on me because I sponged down.
We can attest to it. You're like, you're immaculate.
And, you know, the thing about the sponge, the other beauty of it is unlike a lint roller where you have to throw it away once all the hair and the lint gets on it, you simply run the sponge under the water and the fur comes off it.
Brilliant.
Low tech, very effective. You know, there you go. Well, I actually sponged down the cat once. He didn't like that. He didn't like that.
Not a bad fan.
Now I just sponge the surfaces, which he gets dirty.
Nice. Jordan, what's your upgrade?
Living in New York, where gyms just recently opened, I wanted to get back to the gym, but spend as little time there as possible. So my upgrade, which I tried once and it worked out pretty decently, and I'll try again, is doing as much of my workout as possible on my way to the gym. So I woke up in the morning and I ran a mile to the gym as my warm-up, and I brought a jump rope with me because that was easy enough to carry. I did some jump roping before I got in. I basically got in the gym only to use the weights and the types of things that I wouldn't be able to use outside. And then I ended up running back home. So it's trying to efficiently structure my workout so that I am only indoors in the gym for a really, really limited amount of time and doing all the stuff that I could do outside of the gym.
Do you think ultimately you could work with free weights or stretch bands and not go to the gym, or would that just not work?
I could if I had a bigger apartment. In New York, or at least in my apartment, I just don't have the space to actually do the types of things that I would need to do that a gym would have. So I want to be able to use a gym, but there's a lot that I could do outside of the gym. You know, if I'm going to be jump roping or if I'm going to be doing light-weighted stuff, then I could do that outside of the gym. But when I get into the gym, I just use it specifically for heavy weights that I'm not going to be able to use from my home.
The trick is to be weak like me and then just be like, a resistance band is plenty.
I should just be working on the running part. Just focus on the speed so that I can get away from danger as opposed to fighting it. See, I've watched too many movies. I'm full of myths that I could like fight back against danger instead of just evading.
Running is a greatly underestimated skill when it comes to safety.
Zigzag.
Yeah. Alice, what's your upgrade this week?
So this one, I've been sort of debating if it's an upgrade. It's not an upgrade. It's maybe just more of a tip for other people, but I think it upgrades other people's lives. So I'm gonna go for it.
Roll with it.
Here I go. My dad passed away a couple of weeks ago. And one thing that has helped immeasurably is cards. Like, send a card. It makes such a difference to me. It's such a highlight when I get, you know, opening my little sad Brooklyn mailbox and it's just nothing but junk mail. Getting cards from people has meant so much. And it's like, you don't need to send flowers. You don't need to send food or whatever. I mean, those things are great. Don't get me wrong. I love them. And thank you, Lifehacker team, for sending me all of those things. But cards have been really meaningful. And I found that the people who send me cards seem to be people who've also lost parents. And I feel like they it's like we're in the club now. They know. And I can think of times when I haven't sent a card in the past and felt like, oh God damn it, why didn't I? Yeah, I just didn't realize how much it would mean. So yeah, cards. They really are they're really a bright spot.
It's really lovely.
Yeah.
That personal message, and it's something that you can look at more than once and think about.
Yeah. Yeah, and sharing memories of the person is huge. Like, you're kind of desperate for it. So you're just like, what? Like, I need more, especially because my dad had Alzheimer's for 10 years. So I can't really like remember a lot of things. So people bringing stuff back to me has been immeasurable.
That's awesome, Alice.
Thank you.
Well, Judith, thanks so much for being with us. This was absolutely amazing.
It was fun. Yeah.
And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck and mixed by Brad Fisher.
Please rate us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review too. Those reviews really help us people. You know you want to do it. And you can also reach us by calling us at 347-687-8109 and leaving a voicemail. I can't remember the last time I listened to a voicemail, and you can break that drought. Or you can also write us at upgrade@lifehacker.com.
You can also find us on Twitter at Lifehacker, on Instagram at lifehacker.com, all one word, and on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. Sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter full of tips and tricks and hacks at lifehacker.com/newsletter. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.